welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast, which is a parenting podcast with a difference, because this is all about children with SEND. And every week I speak to a different guest with a different experience, and even with the same diagnosis, it can be an entirely different situation, different challenges, different joys, and a completely different experience. So if it's your first time listening, the reason that I wanted to start this podcast is because when my son Leo was born 2.5 years ago, we got a post-birth diagnosis of Down syndrome, which absolutely rocked our world at the time in a dreadful way. And it really felt like the worst thing that could have happened. I absolutely don't feel like that now, but I was reaching out for support and connection with other people in the same situation. And from that can come something beautiful. So that's the reason for setting up this podcast. And I'm really excited about this week's guest, Claire Cathcart. Now, we came into each other's lives in a slightly unique way, which we talk about at the beginning of this episode. Now, Claire has two children, Jake and Daisy. She's mainly here to talk about Jake. And this episode is amazing. She's so open and honest, which I really appreciated. I will say that some of this is quite hard to listen to. She has been through a hell of a lot. It's got a happy ending. Don't worry. Everybody is fine. But there are some details in this that if you have a child who has cardiac issues, you might find quite difficult to listen to. So just a little warning for you at the beginning of this episode, because Claire's been through a lot with Jake. But the things that she talks about, I really think are going to help other people who are finding themselves in potentially quite a desperate situation. And, you know, as we've discussed many times, even if your child is in a completely different situation, I really feel like some of the things that Claire talks about are going to be things that many of us have felt. So let's get into it. Claire, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
We kind of know each other, don't we? And I thought, actually, it'd be nice to start with that, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So you very kindly hosted one of my charity balls.
I did.
Just over a year ago. And I really wanted you to do it because because obviously I listen to you every morning. When I was pregnant with Jake, like driving to work every morning, I'd be listening to your show.
So let me just jump in. For people who are new to this podcast and new to me, I'm a radio presenter. So in Liverpool, and I have been on breakfast radio forever, which has aged me considerably. So you so you used to listen to a show I did on the radio.
I did, yeah. Every morning driving to work, religiously, I used to listen to it. And like, although you didn't know me, I felt like I knew you, if that made sense. So when I was pregnant with Jake driving to work, you were keeping me company all the way to work. And then all those drives to the hospital in the morning, you were like the last person I'd listen to in the normal world before I went into hospital. So although you didn't know me in a weird way, like I felt that I knew you, and you were like my friend in the car that kept me company before all the hospital serious stuff started every day. So I really wanted you to do it.
I think that's a lovely thing about radio, but also podcasts as well, because there's podcasts that I listen to and I'm like, Vogue and Joanne and my therapist ghosted me are my best friends and they've got absolutely no idea who I am in the real world. So that's kind of how I came into your life. But then you came into mine the other way round when my Leo was born, because I remember I was reaching out to people, but you reached out to me. So your story is very, very different from mine.
Yeah.
But as I've mentioned on this podcast before, it's all kind of under the same umbrella, isn't it, of an extremely challenging time that you weren't expecting to have as a parent. And I remember you reaching out to me on Instagram offering support, and I really appreciated that. And you've also reached out to me to offer a different kind of support when we've been in older hay, and that support was food. We'll come on to that later on. That sounds weird, but it's not. It's really lovely. But let's go back to the beginning. You've got two children, Jake and Daisy. Will you just briefly tell everyone a little bit about them?
Yeah, so Jake is 10 next month. And he was my first baby, and he was born with a heart condition that we weren't expecting, a really rare one, and we didn't know before he was born. And Daisy is his little sister, who has just turned six, who thinks she's Taylor Swift.
And he's
I certainly want to be. Yeah, she's just turned six, and she's almost definitely autistic, but there's no diagnosis yet. But Jake's autistic as well, sorry. But they're very different in that sense. She's like quite a high-functioning version of autism, whereas Jake is classed as non-verbal or pre-verbal, I guess.
Now, I want to talk to you about Jake. Will you just, if you don't mind, go right back to the beginning and tell your story with Jake, please?
Yes, I'll try and make it brief, because like I said to you, it's like it's 10 years worth, so yeah. Sometimes it goes on a bit, I suppose. Jake was my first baby. I did actually have a miscarriage like a few years ago, like quite a late one. But Jake was my first baby. I was actually induced because they were concerned about his heart rate when I was being monitored. So I was induced in like an emergency situation, but he was born and they checked him over and he was absolutely fine. And I just remember thinking, yes, I've done it. I've had a baby. And he's all right. And then the following morning, we were getting ready to go home and he was in his car seat getting ready to go home. And a midwife just decided that she just didn't quite like the look of him. And she had a listen with the stethoscope to his heart. And she said, oh, his heart rate sounds irregular. And I was like, oh, okay. Didn't really think it was that big a deal. Mm-hmm. And then she ordered an ECG. They did the ECG on him. And then straight away, a load of doctors came in and said, your baby's really sick. We need to take him to special baby care. And I said, well, let me get some baby girls for him. And they said, look, he doesn't need that. He just needs to go. And they whisked him away and they said, we'll let you know when you can see him. And that was that, really. So I just sat there. My baby had gone. And I didn't really know what to do. As soon as they'd got him kind of like stable, I guess, I was allowed to go in and see him, and he was in an incubator. And I remember one of the nurses saying, come and change his nappy. And I was like, he was in an incubator, you know, where you put your hands in and stuff. And I remember thinking, I've only just learned how to do a nappy. Like, now I've got to do one. Like, it was like a bush tucker trial to me. I'd just given birth, and I was like, this is a lot. They kept him stable while they were talking to Alder Hay on the phone to get guidance, because his heart rate was like 300.
What should it be, just for context?
I think like 120 or something. Wow. It was irregular as well as fast. And then the following day, the transport team took him to Alder Hay, to a cardiac centre. And I remember thinking, I mean, there's only about 10 minutes between Whiston, where he was born, and Alder Hay, where we went to. But I remember thinking, like, this is really big. Like, he's going to Alder Hay. It's a massive hospital. I just really struggled with the fact that he was going to, like, this special cardiac ward. It just felt really serious. And we couldn't go with him, so we followed. And then we got there and we got to the old cardiac ward in the old hospital, which was K2. And straight away they said, you know, sit down, we'll get you a cup of tea, are you all right? And I was like, why are you being so nice to me? I just couldn't get it. And that sort of became our home, really. They didn't really know what it was with Jake. He was in like a post-surgical bay, so like a high dependency bay on the ward, where kids were recovering from heart surgery and going home and stuff. And they didn't really know what to do with him, because they couldn't work out what was causing this irregular fast rhythm. And he was brand new as well, I suppose, which didn't help. But he obviously wasn't safe enough to go home. We were offered accommodation at Ronald McDonald House, which is an amazing facility. But I needed my own bed, I think. I think the thought of being in like the hospital accommodation, like, just made me feel like it was more, like, even more serious.
But also, you'd like just had a baby as well. So this isn't, it's not a case of physically you're in a kind of normal position looking after a baby. Like, you were, how many days post birth was this?
Like, this was like day two of life, yeah. I suppose. Yeah. I think it was day two. I mean, it's all a massive blur, but like you say, you've just had a baby and like you're obviously not feeling your best anyway.
No.
So I just needed to be in like a normal bed, I think. And then obviously you were keeping me company on the drive-in every day without you even knowing. they tried loads of things to try and get his heart rate into a normal rhythm. Loads of mad things. Adenosine, which is something that they inject into him that gives you in a sense of impending doom, apparently. All kinds of like rhythm medicines and stuff. And then it just got to the point where they were like, well, we can't really do much about his rhythm, but the rate seems to have calmed down, so take him home. So we took him home, and then the following week he had an outpatient appointment. They did a scan on his heart, and his heart function had got worse. So they said, come back next week, we're going to try a heart failure drug. And I'm like, heart failure? What? Because obviously then you Google, and none of that's great. Never Google. So then the following week when he was in to try this drug, he just kept getting sicker. And then right at shift changeover, he had a cardiac arrest on the ward. I remember holding him and saying, could you just look at my baby, please? Because he doesn't quite look right. And then the next thing I knew, the crash team were coming in, and I was in the parents' room, and a nurse was holding my hand, and I'm like, what is going on? An ICU doctor came in and just said, look, we're taking him to ICU. And I said, well, is he going to be all right? And he just looked at the floor, and he was like, you know, I can't say at this moment. Oh, and I'm like, God. What? We only came in to try a medicine. So yeah, that was like his first trip to ICU.
If you don't mind me asking you to kind of go back and in like an emotional way, how do you even hear those words? Because when you ask somebody medical, is my child going to be okay? Obviously, what you're expecting to hear and hoping to hear is, yes, they're going to be fine. Like, how do you, as a brand new mum, hear the words, I don't know?
I just remember being in a state of shock because, like I say, we came in to try a medicine and all of a sudden this is going on. Yeah. I very quickly learned to stop asking that question, if I'm honest with you. And now I kind of think, well, Jake's going to decide what Jake's going to do. Obviously with the help of some very, very clever people, but I don't ask that question anymore because we've been in too many situations where that's been a very real thing. But I think I was just in pure shock about it because I was expecting him to go, yeah, be fine.
Well, yeah, you do.
We'll do some stuff and he'll be fine. Yeah. And he just kind of looked, and then it was the way he looked at the floor more than anything. I was like, oh my God. So yeah, we weren't allowed to see him for a good few hours. And then when we were allowed in, he just didn't look like him. He was ventilated, he'd gone all puffy, and he was wired up to all kinds of different IV medicines. And I was like, is that even my baby? And then obviously you kind of take on the trauma of everything else that's going around because it was a big open bay in the old ICU. So like there's all kinds of heavy things going on around you. And his next door neighbour at that time, a little girl called Willow, who'd had surgery. We're still friends with that family to this day. And they send each other Valentine's cards every year.
Oh, stop.
And we've decided they're getting married. So
obviously.
They don't get a say in it. But that's just how it is. They're getting married, Jake and Willow, forever.
That's cute.
That was basically his first month. Eventually, he got stable enough to go to the ward. Mm-hmm. But there was no real solution to what was going on with him. His heart wasn't pumping properly. The rhythm was really dangerous, so we couldn't go home. And then every time we did go home, we just ended up back in. If he got like a cold or anything like that, he just wasn't well enough to deal with it, so we just ended up back in. And then I think we got readmitted just after Christmas, his first Christmas, because he kept going blue and making this really weird cry. And every time he did it, he'd poo. I talk about poo so much since I've had Jake. I'm so sorry. I'm just immune to it. I'll do it while people are eating and I'll be like, I'm sorry, you don't come from this world. I should stop it. And I remember his consultant that became his consultant was like, Jake Cathcart's here. And I didn't know about it. And he straight away like reviewed everything that was going on with how he was being treated and decided that we needed to try different medicines. We needed a second opinion from somewhere specialist. And he ended up referring into Great Ormond Street in London.
So can I ask, at this point, had you been told, like, this is what this is, or were they still unsure?
Still unsure. We've only just recently found out what it is, to be honest with you. Like, and he's nearly 10.
So how does that feel? Because Polly was talking about this, my first guest. Her twins have got such a rare genetic condition that nobody else has it. And she was saying it was difficult because there isn't kind of a thing where you can go, okay, well, it's called this, so I can research this and I know what the potential outcomes of whatever it is are. How did you feel not being able to do that?
Really frustrating, because like with the structural cardiac kids, you know, the surgeries they can have and they know what to do and they know what the outcomes are. But I mean, we just didn't know. So it was just such an uncertain time. Mm. It does turn out that it is a genetic thing that Jake has. But like I say, we've only just recently found that out because there was kind of genetic study. Mm. Because before Daisy was born, we got told that it wasn't genetic. You're fine to have another baby.
Yeah.
So we had one. And yeah, we've literally only just found out. And they still can't say 100% that it is this genetic condition because there's not been enough research done.
Right.
But basically it is. It's the only thing they can pinpoint it to. And it's a unique genetic mutation that is just with Jake and no one else in the family.
Right.
So, and that gave me a lot of peace because I did blame myself a lot. You know, like, how can I give this baby this heart that doesn't work? How can I put him through all of this stuff? And when the genetics lady told me that, I could not stop crying. But it was like relief in a way, because she said it was nothing you did. And I know it wasn't anything I did anyway, because I was like so careful. And, you know, I really looked after myself. But the fact that, you know, that they can't say 100%, but that's probably what it is, was such a relief. Because like I say, I carried that for like nearly, I think it was like 7 maybe when they told me that. I carried that for like 7 years. What did I do? What could I have done differently? How have I caused this?
I understand that. I think that's quite natural. It's not right. Like, you're wrong. No. Logically, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like that when Leo was born. I was like, what did I do? It must have been something that I did. And my thing for me was, it's because I'm older. Like, this has happened because I'm older and the chances go up and it's my fault. And this at the time felt like this awful thing has happened because of me. Where logically, and it doesn't matter, does it? Everyone around you can go, it's not your fault. You haven't done anything, but that's still in you, isn't it? And until you're able to let that go.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I needed that validation from the genetics woman. I cried all over. I've cried over so many people. Yeah, that was like Jake as a baby, and they referred him to Great Ormond Street, which again felt like this huge leap. It was like, he can't get fixed locally, now we've got to go to London.
Yeah.
Like, why do Northerners always do that? London? But the people at Great Ormond Street, when they looked at his echoes, his ECGs and everything, decided that he wasn't well enough to go there by road. He had to go via air.
Oh, God.
And because he needed to go via air, he needed a full ICU team to go with him. 7 months old, I think he was, having his first helicopter ride. And we just had to follow. Fortunately, there was a train from Liverpool to London, like shortly after the helicopter left. My mum's car was running. So we literally waved my baby off in his helicopter, jumped into a car with the engine running, and my mum drove like ridiculously fast to get us to Lime Street, and we literally got to the train as it was pulling away pretty much, and then got on the train to London, met him at Gosh.
That must have been the most horrific train journey.
Oh, it was awful. Just the fact that I'm scared of flying anyway, so to see my baby get in a helicopter and not be with him and not know what we're actually walking into and what's going to happen when we get there, because by that point I'd started like Googling and seeing that this could probably result in transplant happening. So I knew that serious things were going to happen when we got there. Obviously we'd never been before and we had to find it, and we were like running from Euston to get there. And then when we got there, he was basically just being settled and everyone was fussing over him because he was such a lovely baby. And yeah, that was like, I think 2 weeks of them basically scratching their heads again, wondering what to do with him. I'm like, right, we're in Goshen, they don't know what to do. Where do we go from here? So they decided after a lot of consideration and meetings and stuff, his best chance would be this CRT pacemaker, which is basically a very bespoke pacemaker that they do quite a lot in old people that resynchronizes the way the heart beats, which improves function and improves the way the heart pumps. We were allowed home while we waited for that surgery date. And then came back. His surgery was scheduled for just before his first birthday. And we were really hopeful that he was going to be home for his first birthday. But unfortunately, he was really poorly after that surgery. And he arrested again whilst he was recovering from the surgery in front of us. We watched the team work on him, which was horrific. And what they realised was he had a hole in his heart, which was actually helping when his heart wasn't beating properly. But once they'd done the pacemaker operation, it was kind of working against him and it made him really, really poorly. So they knew that the only way to fix this was to close the hole, but he wasn't stable enough, they thought, to go on bypass, which is what they have to do for open heart surgery. And I could hear them talking, saying, is he well enough to go on it? And I'm like, yes, do it. So they decided to do that the day after his birthday, which was the following week. They kept him ventilated, sedated, paralysed for his first birthday. And they said, look, this is going to be really unstable. We're not sure if he's going to come out of it. We're just preparing you. This is not going to be smooth sailing. So we spent his first birthday just thinking, well, this is probably going to be his first and his last one. And we're in London and we've got no family with us or anything. And the staff were great. They made banners for his birthday. They got a birthday cake. They sang happy birthday to him. And they tried to make it as nice as it could be. But obviously, you know, he was fast asleep and we had this big surgery the following day. So it was pretty rough. And then the next day he had the surgery and he absolutely sailed through it. He smashed it. Came out, all his numbers were good, he was stable. They extubated him the following day. I think the day after that he went to the ward, and shortly after that they were like, you can go home. We were like, really? And yeah, they were like, yeah, just sort out the train and go home. We're like, we don't have to go in a helicopter, we can just get on the train and take him home. Obviously he had this device, he had the pacemaker, and he still had a load of like heart failure meds and rhythm meds and things, and he had to have regular checkups, and he was at Alderhay quite a bit, and we had to go to London for his pacing checks and things like that. But we had what I thought was quite a normal life after that. Mm-hmm. I mean, looking back, it really wasn't, because we were in hospital a lot.
Had you become used to that, do you think?
Yeah. I was fully institutionalised at Alderhay. I had my hospital friends, my nurses, you know, like quite a good social circle in there, because when I was at home, we didn't really go anywhere because Jake wasn't well enough.
Yeah.
So I actually had a nicer time in there than I did at home. Like, he'd get his music therapy and we'd do baby massage classes and loads of lovely things while we were in there. And he got spoiled rotten in there as well. So, yeah, we took him home. And apart from staying in hospital quite frequently, I was able to go back to work. Jake was on warfarin at the time as well, actually, which is something that thins your blood to prevent you from getting a stroke. So I'd quite often be doing toe prick bloods on him before I was going to work, because you had to do it first thing in the morning. But I managed it all. I think he was on 14 meds a day. But he went to nursery. He went to an amazing nursery that looked after him so well. We even started puddle ducks, which he loves because he loves the water. And even though he's behind developmentally, things like that, he was just another kid, and he was just the same as everyone else in those situations. And it was so good for his development and stuff. And he started school. We put him in mainstream school, really close to where we live. And then we kind of thought that he was obviously miles behind the other kids, but hopeful that he was going to make it up once he started at school. And then obviously COVID happened and there was no school. And then in lockdown, he started to get really sick. He stopped eating and drinking. He was losing weight. He was looking pale and lethargic. He just looked terrible. And I kept taking him to A&E and saying, he's not okay. There's something wrong here. And we kept getting sent home saying he's fine. But I could just see him fading in front of me. It got to the point where I was syringing water in 10 mil at a time just to make sure that he got enough water. And in the end, I ended up taking a picture of him looking terrible. And I sent it to his consultant. I didn't even have his email. I just worked it out from his name. And I said, I'm really worried that he's dying. Can you please do something? Because I'm sick of being sent home and I don't know what to do. So they agreed to admit him for a week of tests. And on the way to the hospital, he nearly died in the car. I was driving there and in the mirror, I could see him and he just went. His eyes rolled back and he just went. And I had to drop off Daisy at nursery first. I got out of the car. I probably should have dialed 999 or something, but I was just in panic mode, yeah. I think. And I got to Daisy's nursery and they must have seen the look on my face and they just took the baby off me and I just drove down the 62, one hand on the steering wheel, one hand shaking this child, going, God, like, wake up, Jake, wake up. And then when we got there, he'd sort of come to a bit and they did a scan and the consultant walked in and just said, his function's worse, Claire. And I knew. I already knew at this point. I'd known for a while that this is what was happening. But and then when she said that, I just knew we're going to London. He's going to need support for his heart and he's going to need a transplant if we're ever going to get him home. And that is exactly what happened.
What was happening with Daisy at this point? How old was she?
She was 18 months, I think.
Right.
And that was the last time I saw her. Not ever, but the last time I saw her until we got home after Jake's transplant.
And how long was that?
4 months.
I mean, how did you cope with that? Because that's not just everything going on with Jake, which is something that you shouldn't, you know, no parent would ever dream of having to deal with. But then you've got a baby that you aren't seeing as well. How did you cope with that?
I mean, it was awful and I felt terrible, but I knew I had to just get this child to safety. Yeah. She ended up staying with grandparents and I knew she was getting spoiled rotten. And we did FaceTime and things like that. And I knew she was having the time of her life and she was getting everything she needed. She wasn't allowed to come to London anyway because of the COVID restrictions.
Yeah.
But being in a hospital while all this serious stuff was no place for a baby or a toddler to be. So I knew she was in the right place and I felt awful, especially because we weren't with her over Christmas. But I knew that was the best thing for her. The worst thing was when I came back and she'd forgotten who I was.
Oh, God.
I always used to say to her, D-A-I-S-Y, and she'd go, Daisy! And I walked through the door and I did it and she was like, who are you? And I was like, oh, my God, you've forgotten me.
Oh, God. That's heartbreaking.
And she was really wary of me. Oh, it was awful. She was like, really like, you sound a bit familiar, but I don't know who you are. And I was like, oh, my God, you've completely forgotten me in 4 months. What about all this stuff we did together before?
Yeah.
But I mean, she soon settled back into it and stuff when we were reunited. But I think that was the hardest thing, coming back and she didn't know. But I knew that she was in the best place for her and I needed to be with him to get him better.
Yeah. Talk me through then what happened with Jake while you were down there for those 4 months.
So we flew there, just me and Jake, because of the, like I say, the COVID restrictions. And he just kept getting sicker. I ended up saying to them, can you please take him to ICU? Because I don't feel he's safe here. He needs to go to ICU. He refused to get in a bed. So they were nursing him on the floor because he would not get in the bed. And I just remember the following morning, they said, he's the sickest child on this unit. We need to have ECMO, which is like life support, on standby. We need to ventilate him. And they were talking about who was going to do what when he crashed, not if. And he's just sitting there with his Twister ice lolly looking at them defiantly. And I'm like, how can he be this sick? He's just... But yeah, so they intubated him. And obviously, because it was COVID, they were all in PPE. And I just remember feeling like, you know, that feeling like you want to get off a roller coaster or a ride, or when you're up in a plane, you want to put your foot down, but you're not because you're in the air. I just remember feeling like I want to get off. I couldn't see anyone's faces properly, and I didn't know anyone, and all this heavy stuff was going on. And it was just terrifying. They put me in like the bad news room, I suppose. And I just remember sitting there thinking, I don't know if they walk in this through this door, what they're going to say to me. Like, are they going to come in and tell me he's gone, or are they going to come in and tell me he's all right? And they came in and they said, like, we've managed to get him ventilated, but he is very, very sick. We're going to have to take it minute by minute, I think they said. But he held his own over the weekend. And then on the Monday morning, we bumped into the transplant team and they said, we need to have a talk. And I was like, now I knew that was his only hope at that point. But the way they said that, I wasn't sure if they were going to list him because he was so sick. When we did have that talk, I felt like I was, you know, fighting his case, because they were asking, you know, what kind of a boy is Jake developmentally? What's he like? And I'm thinking, oh, because he's behind, are they not going to list him? So I was just, I felt like I was fighting for his life in there. And they basically said, you know, we're willing to list him. We're a bit concerned about the fact that he won't get in a bed. But his only chance, because he's not going to survive waiting for a heart to become available, because you're looking at a year wait, is a bridge to transplant, which is a Berlin heart, which is basically mechanical support for the heart. It's two pumping chambers that do the job of the pumping chambers of the heart that are, like, fitted but external to the body. They're connected to this massive metal machine, and then there's a laptop on top of it that controls the cardiac output. It's fitted in an 8-hour operation. It's very risky. There's lots of complications. They have to thin the blood, which puts you at risk of getting of internal bleeding. There's risks of clots and clots traveling. Any bangs to the head could be really serious. And you can't guarantee that it's going to work long term anyway. But that was his only chance. So it was either that or they withdraw treatment and we said goodbye there and then. So we went with it. He got put on the urgent list. He had the operation the following week. And his recovery was very stormy. He had a collapsed lung nearly every day. He was losing blood every day. He needed a blood transfusion pretty much every day, which they don't like to do when you're awaiting a transplant, because the more transfusions you have, the more difficult transplant is. Yeah, every complication going happened. There were a few times they'd have to reintubate him, and I think every time that they were doing that, this would be the last time. I genuinely don't know how they turned it around sometimes, because he was so sick. But they did, and he was starting to get better and, like, well enough to come out of ICU. But then the restrictions got even more strict because of COVID, and that would have meant one parent per week if we'd have gone out of ICU. So we held on to our ICU time as long as possible. Spent Christmas on ICU. He was at that point like the wellest and most awake child on the unit. Like, we had a great Christmas. They really looked after us. We probably had a better Christmas than the staff because of COVID. They had to go home and be on their own. But we had all these people around us, and like there was loads of crafts and Santa visits and stuff. And we had a great time, which sounds awful, I know. And then shortly after Christmas, we got the phone call. I was terrified of the phone ringing when I wasn't with him. So I keep my phone on silent because my phone ringing used to make me jump. And I was making a cup of tea and I saw that there was a missed call from the hospital. I was like, oh my God, he's died. Like, so straight away, I just go to worst case. So I rang it back and his nurse answered. And I said, did you just ring me? And she went, let me just get someone. And I was like, oh my God. I thought, this is it. Like, you know, we've lost him. And then a lady got on the phone and I was like, is Jake okay? And she said, overnight we've had an offer of a heart. And I that was it. I just lost it. And she said, you know, it's early days, we don't know if this is going to go ahead, but it's looking really positive. So if you'd like to come over and we can talk about it there. So the cup of tea did not get drunk. We legged it straight over. And Jake was all like, "Mummy, mummy."
How old is he at this point?
5.
Okay.
And he'd just been able to start eating again because of all the complications, but obviously was now nil by mouth because he was approaching a transplant operation. So he just kept asking for food, and we had to spend the entire day just distracting him from the fact that he couldn't eat. And then it's just the weirdest day because you don't know if it's going to go ahead until it's going ahead. So it could have been the biggest day of our lives, or it could have been like, oh, false alarm, as you were, sort of thing. But it did go ahead. And the surgeon that did all his operations as a baby did the transplant operation. And I remember saying, "I'm so glad it's you." And he was like, "I'm so glad it's Jake." And it was just like, he's the most amazing man in the world. And yeah, we handed him over. And everything went as it should. We got to see him straight afterwards. All his numbers were good. Everything was perfect. He had a normal heart rhythm for the first time in his life. His chest was open. That was a lot. And yeah, everything was fine. They managed to close his chest. The following day, they extubated him. Then he was standing up and doing physio. And everything was going great. We could have gone home week 2, but I was too scared because we were so far away from London. So we went home week 3. And his recovery has been perfect ever since.
So that must have been like the biggest relief ever.
Yeah.
And I guess you must have thought, right, things are going to be like everybody else's version of normal now. But that's not quite how it went, is it?
No, it's not. We came home and Jake and Daisy could not stand each other. And at this point, Daisy was big enough to stand up for herself, and still COVID, obviously, so couldn't really go anywhere. And my beautiful, sweet boy that was no trouble to anyone, all of a sudden was a menace, shall we say. The first time he could go out, I took him to the park, and he had this huge meltdown I've never seen before in my life. And it just kept getting worse. He worked out that he could smash all our light sockets. So we lost all our light sockets and plug sockets. 4 flat screen TVs got smashed within the space of 2 weeks, I think it was. He bounced through all the beds, rubbed food into the carpet, into the walls, loads of really destructive stuff that I now know is sensory stuff. So we actually got an autism diagnosis when he was in ICU, but it wasn't really a priority for me at the time because he was so sick. And I just remember thinking, it was over the phone, and I said, right, well, if he survives, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. Because I didn't see it because he was too poorly to show it. And then we got home and it was like a light had been switched on, and he was doing all this crazy stuff that I just didn't know how to deal with and couldn't control.
So was it almost like all of those health issues had kind of masked everything else?
Yeah, definitely. I guess he didn't have the energy before, and now all of a sudden he was supercharged. I remember bringing this organisation that's meant to help with this stuff, and I said, can I just explain to you, my son's had a transplant and all of a sudden this is happening. And she said, your situation's no different to anyone else. You need to figure this out for yourself. Oh, and I just remember thinking, but it is different. Listen to me. Let me tell you. And she was like, no, go on these courses online and read this paperwork. There's so much paperwork involved in autism for something that's not like typical. And I just find there's just so much paperwork involved in it. I really, really struggled with it. And I couldn't take the kids out at the same time because they couldn't stand each other. And I just remember the only place I thought I could go outside of the house where I'd be safe was my work's car park. And I just remember sitting in my work's car park with these 2 kids, just thinking, this is horrendous. And just sitting there crying, thinking, I can't do this. I can't manage it.
I mean, that must have been really difficult to process, because on the one hand, you must be like extremely grateful and so relieved that part of, I mean, I know it's not as simple as he has a new heart and it's done. I know that that's not how it works, but essentially that traumatic part of your journey is done and he's healthy. But then on the other hand, that kind of sounds like you're living a different nightmare.
Yeah, I often think with the cardiac stuff, I know what to do, I know where to go, I know what the routine is, but autism, and I'm still learning now, was just a completely different thing, and I find it harder than the heart stuff sometimes. And I just felt completely helpless. I ended up reaching out to this charity. They're called Autism in Motion. I think they've possibly changed their name now to something else. And the lady that ran the charity said, "Where do you live? I'm going to come and meet you." And she met me at the Starbucks near where I live. And I literally just cried on her. And she said, you need support, you need help, I'm going to help you. And she suggested some things, and she was like, try this and let me know how you get on. And one of the things she mentioned was Rebound, which is trampolining. And I just remember, like, she was very nice and very kind, but I remember thinking, you want me to put him on a trampoline and that's going to fix everything? Are you joking? But I contacted the lady that she mentioned that does the Rebound stuff, and we went there, and straight away Jake got on the trampoline, and straight away he made eye contact with this lady, and he was engaged and he was listening, and I could not believe what was going on. It, like, right before my eyes, he just changed completely. And then it finished, and he was like, he was calm, he was happy. And I couldn't believe the difference it had made in him. We still do that now. He goes once a week to his Rebound class. And it has made the world of difference with his communication and his development and just overall how he is as a kid. The next thing we did was to look at a more appropriate school for him, because he obviously wasn't going to make up the gap. And we just kept getting negative feedback on everything. And he was coming home, and they call it the Coke bottle effect. Like, he was bottling it all up at school, and then when he got home, he'd just destroy things. So I started to look at special provisions, but unfortunately, where we live, they were all full. In the end, I found one 14 miles away, which is actually near where I work, which is handy. And he's been there a year now, and the difference has been phenomenal. They teach the way he learns, and I'm now able to take both kids out to places other than a car park and cry. We pick our battles. There's certain parks I know we can go to. They're both big fans of a mini train, so anything that involves a mini train, we go to. There's a special Send swimming lesson that's not too far from Alderhay that they go to. I can take them both at the same time. Jake's a big fan of the cinema as well. Not autistic screenings, though, because he's not that keen on autistic kids, even though he is one. So we just go towards the end of a showing when there's hardly anyone there, and he's got the whole cinema to himself then. But his communication, he can write, he can draw pictures. And I wouldn't say it's perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm still learning and figuring all this out. But it's definitely manageable now, a good few years into it. And we're definitely in a much better place than we were in the early days. Once we got, like, the right support in place. He goes to a little playgroup every other weekend, so I get some time with Daisy. Because I appreciate that Jake and keeping him alive has taken a front seat. And she often says to me, "You only like Jake, you don't like me." And I feel awful about it. So every other Saturday is like mine and Daisy's day, and we go and do stuff together. Like, I try my best to give them, like, equal amounts of time now. And we try and do more stuff together as well, and now we can, because they're getting on a bit better. Jake's accepted that Daisy is Daisy and not George the pig from Peppa Pig. he just really struggled with the fact that she was a girl. He was disgusted by her. So yeah, we're definitely in a much better place now.
I hope you don't mind me asking, have you had any help for you? Because what you've described, that story, well, it's not a story, is it? It's your life from Jake being born. That's real trauma there for you. You know, yeah. Have you had any help to process that and deal with that?
They kind of make you see a psychologist.
Good.
Before they list your child. It's like one of the prerequisites. It's like, we will list him, but you have to speak to someone,
because
it's a lot to take on. And when I take Jake to his transplant clinic in London, the psychologist is there, and you can kind of, like, reach out. But I'm all right if he's all right, if that makes sense. The minute he's poorly, I'm like, oh my God, like it kind of like flares up. But I think we've been really lucky. We could have been in there for a year, 2 years. I know families that waited 2 years. I know families that didn't get the call, and families that have had loads of complications since. And we've been so lucky. And the support is there. And I have reached out when horrible things have happened to people that are in my circle, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But other than that, I'm good. But I can reach out to it if I want to.
I think it's a testament to your strength of character and the person that you are that you've just described yourself as lucky, given what you've been through.
I always say that about the rest of us in our little Team 1C circle, that we're like the luckiest unlucky people in the world because we've got such good care.
How does it feel telling that story? Because when I started this podcast, I sat down and told my story because I thought I can't expect people to come on here and bare their souls and share everything that they've been through if I haven't done the same first. But after I'd recorded my episode, I thought, it's strange, I don't often tell that story from beginning to now. I mean, you know, Leo's only 2.5, but going through everything for you, do you tell that story from beginning to end often? And how does it feel when you do? Because a lot of the time, people I speak to go, well, you just take things day by day and you just deal with things as they come up. But going through the whole thing is a bit different, isn't it?
I mean, it's quite cathartic, really. But I think, was it Polly from your first guest? She said she goes quite, like, she'll talk about it. But I'm quite robotic when I talk about Jake's story. And then if I stop and think about it, then I get upset about it. Or if someone's nice to me. Yeah. Or if someone, like, when you just asked, have you had any support? I was like... Oh, someone goes, oh, I think you're really brave. And then that's when I'll lose it, I think. And if people go, and are you okay? And I'm like, well, don't ask about me. it's when people are nice to me. But I'm when it's Jake, I'm like in the zone, like very matter of fact and try and stick to the facts with it. Because getting that right for him is like massively important. Yeah. And then someone will go, are you all right? And I'll be like, yeah, I'm okay.
You mentioned Team 1C, and I'd like to talk to you about that because I think this is something amazing that you've done. So what exactly is that?
Team 1C is my difficult middle child. So when Jake was about 2, he stopped breathing at my mum's house and I had to do CPR on him. And he was taken to hospital straight away and he had everything he needed to help him get better immediately. And I remember scrolling on my phone and I saw that one of the surgeons at the hospital volunteered their spare time to perform heart surgery on children that weren't as lucky as us in a country with no NHS. And purely because of funds, these children would otherwise die unless they had heart surgery. And I remember seeing the value of these heart surgery camps. It was £6,000. And I remember thinking, that's nothing. Like £6,000 would mean that 10 children could live. So I just messaged all my hospital friends and I was like, let's raise some money. Let's see if we can raise enough for one of these camps. We decided to have a ball because we all needed a night out. And we raised enough for 4, I think. And then we did another ball and raised enough for another 4. And I think to date now, we've funded enough for about 213 heart surgeries for children in Africa, Palestine, India, Romania, and giving those kids a chance at life. I mean, obviously the medics do the important bit. We just raise the funds. And now Team 1C is a registered charity, which is a lot more work than I thought it would be, which is why it's my difficult middle child. But yeah, we've done that. We've raised money for the hospital. We've raised money to fund an apartment at Ronald McDonald House as well. And then on a Sunday night, we bring food to parents of children in critical care because parents of children in critical care don't look after themselves properly. And you need to, so you can be the best that you can for your child while they're in hospital. So we bring the food to them to make sure they eat.
It's such a lovely thing to be able to give back like that.
I think because we've been there and we know where the gaps are and we can we can fill them. And the heart surgery camps that we've done have been named after children that have passed away from our little circle. So it's like their legacy as well.
That's beautiful.
Our families get a lot out of it as well. As the families that we help.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times about your hospital friends. How Yes. important were and are those connections to you? Because you've obviously spent a lot of time in there in what could be described as quite a dire situation.
They're the people that understand. You know, with the best will in the world, your friends outside of that can be sympathetic, but they don't know what it's like to live that life. And like when one of us is in hospital and it's like a different hospital, like the first thing you do is ask if your child's all right, and then it's like, oh, what's your bed like? We TripAdvisor all these hospitals. You need that support and you need that understanding. And then from Team 1C, we've done stuff outside of being in a hospital in a scary environment. And we've had the nights out and we've done the fundraising things and the abseiling and all that kind of stuff. And we've got such a close bond, all of us, because of what we've been through. And it's just so nice when we do stuff that's not serious. We just have the best time together. And I could not have got through the past 10 years without them. And I really hope that, you know, I've helped them as much as they've helped me.
I'm sure you have.
We are like a family, very dysfunctional.
I'm going to finish by asking the same two questions I ask all my guests. And the first question is, what's the best piece of advice that you've been given along this journey?
The best piece of advice I think would be that you know your child better than anyone. You're an expert in your child, and parental concern is a very real thing. And if you think that something isn't quite right, you need to trust that and trust your gut and go with it, and don't let go until you've been heard. Because you see that child every day, you know when something's not quite right. You're the expert. You might not be a medical expert, but you're the expert in your child.
My other question, I'm going to change it slightly for you, because my previous guests have been a little more clear cut. You know, they've had a diagnosis and then they've moved on from there. So I've asked everybody else, what do you wish you'd known, you know, at the start? But I guess at any point throughout this journey with Jake, is there anything that stands out that you wish you'd known then that would have helped?
Just that it gets easier. I think you get a lot more support as they get older, especially from the age of 8 for some reason with the autism thing. And I wish I could tell that person that was sitting in my works car park that it's not always going to be like this and it will get easier and I'll be able to do things with them other than sit in a car park and cry. And I just wish I'd known at the time. And I also think it's important, like, to look back as well. The things that I've been terrified of doing. And then, like, now I do Jake's bloods myself and all that kind of things. Like, I am quite proud of how far we've all come with it. And I wish I could tell that person who started out on this journey, who was terrified, that it is going to get easier and things are going to be okay. I really do.
Well, I'm going to make sure that I put the details for Team 1C and the other kind of support services that you've mentioned in the show notes. So if anyone has resonated with anything that you've said, they can easily find out the things that you've been talking about, like Rebound and things like that. But Claire, I've really enjoyed having you on. Thank you so much for being so honest and open with your story. And I think you're amazing.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I think you're amazing too. And Leo is gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad that Claire agreed to come on. I think there's going to be lots of things from that episode that people listening will resonate with, regardless of whether their child has a heart condition or not, because I thought she was so open and honest, and I really, really appreciate that from Claire and all of my guests, to be honest, so far. Some of that was really hard to listen to. And I think it just shows how strong she is that she's able to come on and tell that story in the hope that it does help other people, because I know that she wants to do that. And you can see that, you know, she's set up with the help of other people, that charity Team 1C. And I think it's an incredible thing to come from a place of such despair at times and find something positive to come out of that and then move forward to help other people. I just think it's incredible. So I really hope you enjoyed listening to Claire's story. I hope you found it helpful. And if you have enjoyed listening to this or any of the other episodes, it would be amazing if you could rate 5 stars only, please, and review, because it helps other people to find this podcast. And I really want other people to find this podcast, because I think although everybody's experience is different, it's under the same umbrella and it can bring up a lot of the same emotions, something completely different with our amazing children. I know some of the conversations I've had with people who've been listening, and something that's resonated with them that's absolutely completely different to their situation, but it's about the emotion of it all, isn't it? And that's kind of what this podcast is all about. So that's it for now, and I will be back with another fantastic guest next week. Thank you so much for listening.